Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
David Lee Roth is your artist of the day. Good afternoon, Kansas City. It's good to be with you. If you have a question for the good doctor, get in now at 576-7798. Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System, who has been very generous with his time over the last few weeks. We've gotten to know you probably better than you want us to know you. And, Doctor, welcome. It's good to have you back.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, Dr. Hawkinson, the Kansas City, Missouri Chamber, in conjunction with a whole bunch of partners, they're going around town with these great T-shirts that say, stay safe, stay home. And a bunch of us got some of the shirts. We're wearing them today. I want to ask you, are people staying home as we continue with this push to try to keep people social distancing? And if so, are we actually flattening the curve?
Well, I think those are two different questions. I think certainly anecdotally, I've seen, you know, less groups out in public areas such as parks, the Plaza, Westport, Brookside, things like that. So I think that's a very good thing. As far as are we flattening the curve, you know, certainly here at the medical center, the health system and the KU hospital, we have had the same number of patients for the past few days. And we don't want to be overly optimistic, but certainly hopefully that will continue to stay the same or improve as we move forward. But I think, you know, the nature of this infection, where people can be infected for a week, 2 weeks, and not have any symptoms and then get, you know, severely ill, I think we're still in that period, and so I think going from the next 7 to 10 to 14 days, we're really going to have a lot better information, and we're hoping to have, you know, better information by the end of next week.
If you have a question for the doctor, it's 576-7798, 576-7798. Doctor, the Surgeon General over the weekend, I'm sure you saw or heard, said that this is going to be the coronavirus version of Pearl Harbor or 9/11. Do you believe that to be true?
Yeah, you know, I'm always really reluctant to make analogies like that with this and something like Pearl Harbor, where we had obviously, you know, young men and women volunteering, and then 9/11, we certainly had more young men and women volunteering to go headstrong into danger. This is certainly difficult and trying times, and I think we're going to see, you know, still, we've already seen it around the country, but I think there's still probably more to come, more suffering. But that is why we are so vigilant in trying to say, you know, stay at home, wash your hands, do these very, very simple things to try and stop the spread so that we can stop, you know, as much suffering as we're able to.
And how do you impress upon people, Doctor, because my husband and I were even talking about this before he went into work today. He said if you watch, say, ABC News at night or CNN at night, they are focused on New York, as they should be. There is a crisis unlike anything they have seen in a long time, healthcare-wise, in that city. And so a lot of the national coverage is dominated by what they are seeing on the ground in New York. And I wonder if part of the disconnect is coming in because we are not seeing, and thank God we are not seeing, New York-level crisis numbers here. Mm-hmm. And how do we be vigilant with reminding people that just because we're not seeing that here doesn't mean that couldn't happen here?
Yeah, absolutely, it can happen here. You know, a week before Louisiana saw a surge in their cases, and they are very overwhelmed now. They, you know, they thought they had missed the surge. We know that Detroit's had a surge. We know that prior to New York, Seattle had the surge. It can absolutely happen here. And I think that what we need to do as medical professionals, as the health system, our local celebrities and sports teams, you, the media, which, again, you know, I complimented you guys last week. You guys have been very good about this. I think it's just continuing to hammer away the message and telling people, you know, this is a dangerous disease. Yeah, you, if you're young, you know, you may not be too ill, but you can certainly spread it to someone who is at higher risk of significant and critical illness. And it just goes to the point of we need to keep hammering away the message so that people understand, and it just becomes not even a second thought to them, but they're doing that out of their own responsibility.
Dr. Hawkinson, we're now entering the third week of a metro-wide shutdown here in Kansas City. Is there a possibility, if we keep playing the game, that we won't get hit like New York, like Detroit, like Miami, et cetera?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's very much that possibility, but it takes continuing to the social distance and physical distancing, but even more so, because we know not everybody is doing it, and I think there was an estimate of around 35% of people who are actually abiding by that. If we can get that number even higher, say up to 70, then we can actually start to see a flattening of the curve. But I think that if we continue to do that, you know, optimistically, absolutely, I think that that can be done.
Real quick, doctor, what is your barometer for when we are on that curve? So you mentioned the number of cases that you guys have seen anecdotally have stayed the same day to day the last few days. When for Kansas City can you say we're at the top and starting to come down?
Yeah, and I think that is just mostly a retrospective look, as we can look back as we get more and more days of data, more and more days of knowing how many patients we have in the metro area, in the area hospitals, and then look back. I think that's when we're really going to be able to tell that. I don't think in the midst of it right now that we're really able to say that.
Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System joining us on the hotline. I know we've got a full board of calls, so everybody hang tight. We'll get to all of your calls and your questions in just a moment here on KMBZ. Throwback to the 80s. We are honored to be joined by Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System. Doctor, a lot has been made in the news today, and we'll get to your calls and your comments here in just a moment. Thank you for them. About the racial disparity regarding coronavirus. For example, it was mentioned today that black people make up 32% of the population of Louisiana, but they account for 70% of the deaths. Can you explain this?
No, I've seen that other stories as well, and I've seen certainly my colleagues who are also treating patients here. There's a concern about that. We know that there's been media stories about that. It's really difficult to say. There have been just different theories as to why that is. I think up even in the Northeast, they're seeing more of a disparity with Hispanic patients as well. So it's unclear if it's, you know, we really do not believe that it's anything genetic or biological. It's certainly possibly due to, you know, lack of social distancing, continuing to gather, things of that nature, more socioeconomic really than anything genetic or biological. But again, this is a new disease. You know, we're still learning all these processes. It is certainly unfortunate, but I think the leading theory is more that it's more social types of things rather than anything genetic or biological.
I think, Doctor, we all understand it's going to take some time to get the immunology test, to get the vaccine up and running, but it has dominated headlines in the last couple of days that companies are coming out of the woodwork and starting to test this stuff, that the FDA has green-lighted you know, a much faster process for some of this stuff. What is the latest, and when can we realistically expect to actually see some of these things in our community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the best thing we have going now for diagnostics is basically the PCR, or the genomic test that we're doing to diagnose acute infection. I think moving forward, certainly serology or antibody tests will be very helpful in determining what the prevalence of the disease was, who had evidence of exposure but didn't get any symptoms, things of that nature. Right now, one of our physicians here, one of our lab director physicians, actually wrote a very good answer to that question, because it was asked by our physicians as well, because it has been so popularized. Right now, a lot of tests and a lot of labs are getting the green light from the FDA to do these types of things, but they really have not been validated because everybody is trying to produce something to be helpful for one reason or another. So they haven't really been validated. And the biggest issue is, if I'm going to do a test, I want to make sure that that test is correct and it tells me that you've had COVID-19, SARS-2. Some of these, you know, there still is concern, is it cross-reaction with maybe one of the other lesser severe coronaviruses, the ones that cause common colds. So there's various reasons why maybe currently right now those types of antibody tests are not the best for diagnosing acute infection.
Let's go to Jason in North Kansas City. Jason, good afternoon and welcome, my friend.
Hey, thank you for having me. I've got a question about just outside, being outside in general. You know, it's a nice day today. We're going to go walking around the neighborhood. There's going to be kids outside playing in their yards and people walking by. So I'm just curious how concerned we should be just being out in general like that. You know, if we're walking by and somebody's coughing or you know, can we contract it? How likely are we to contract it through the air or for it, you know, to get on our clothes or our shoes and then to contract it later in that way?
Yeah, I think if you're outside, again, that's good. You know, again, my dermatologist friends would not want to hear this, but get some vitamin D or wear sunscreen. But get outside, be active. If you're just walking by people, and you mentioned kids playing, as hopefully the kids are all in the same household, but you really should not have a lot of risk factor for getting COVID-19 from that type of interaction, as long as you're staying otherwise socially distance or physically distance, you know, just walking by, you're going to be pretty safe. It's not going to pose a large risk at all.
Go ahead, Dana.
Doctor, you want to weigh in on the mask debate? We've gone kind of full circle from we shouldn't be wearing them to now we should be wearing them. And we've got so many mixed messages. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that certainly it is still consistent with what we have said from day one, that this disease is most likely transmitted by droplets. So that's fairly large particles, although we really can't see them with our naked eye for the most part. But droplets, not airborne. Now, we know that some procedures that we're doing in the hospital, such as intubation or surgeries, can aerosolize and make even smaller droplets. But for the most part, this is probably spread by droplets, either droplets being coughed or sneezed, and sometimes we've even seen there's been some reports out there by just talking in some instances. But those droplets either going directly from the patient to other people and causing illness, or maybe being deposited on surfaces and then people using hands, you know, if they're at the store to pick up something and then they're putting their hands in their face. So the face masks are, at this point in time, are still more to protect people who may or may not be symptomatic from spreading it to other people. It's the hope that these simple cloth, bandana, or scarf masks will be enough to stop the penetration of the droplets when somebody is talking or coughing or sneezing from dispersing as much as they would if they didn't have it on. Now, again, still in the hospital and the healthcare settings, we are using biomedical-grade masks to help protect as well. This is more for people who don't know that they're sick, to really try and stop the spread from someone who is asymptomatic to other people. Because we think that there is pretty good evidence you can probably spread it at least a day, if not a couple days, prior to getting ill or having symptoms.
Let me stop you there. 576-7798, Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System, joining us on the hotline. More with him in just a moment here on KMBZ. Tuesday throwback to the 80s. Billy Idol. On this throwback. Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System joining us on the hotline. Doctor, when we first met about 3 weeks ago in studio, back when we actually got to see each other face to face, you said, I have no doubt that I'm, and I'm paraphrasing you here, but I'll be close enough to be dangerous. You said, I have no doubt that I'll get coronavirus. I don't think I'll get it in the hospital. I think I'll get it just walking out in public. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, I was, asked that question the other day. Absolutely, you know, if there's a risk that I'm going to get it, it's probably going to be when I am out, you know, doing the essential errands like going to the grocery store. It's not going to be because I'm here in the hospital. This is, you know, one of the safest places. We've tried to make it safe for our patients, for other healthcare workers, using PPE and frequent hand washing or hand sanitizing with alcohol gels is done. And so I think, again, the biggest risk is going to be out in public.
It was interesting, Dr. Hawkinson. I went to Trader Joe's today, and they're allowing one in, one out, and it was very quick. When you are standing outside, they've drawn little feet on the sidewalk so that everyone is 6 feet apart as you stand in their little chalk feet outside. And I think all of those things are helping. One of the questions that have come up a lot, especially in the last week or so, are you personally wiping down all of the groceries that you bring home? Should we be doing that, or is that too much?
Yeah, I mean, all these things are out of an abundance of caution, and it's because we certainly know, but unclear for how long, that the virus can stay present on surfaces such as cans, bottles, things of that nature. I have started wiping those off or washing those off. I know people do it, you know, when they're ordering takeout, things like that. So I don't think that's a bad idea to do. I don't think in the environment the virus is going to be in high enough concentrations in 3 days, although we know it can live on surfaces for 3 days. But I think certainly coming home from the store and wiping or washing bottles, cans, other packaging off is not an unreasonable thing to do.
From the text line, doctor, to the doctor, is it true that you can double up on vitamin C or drink apple cider vinegar and that will help keep the COVID-19 symptoms reduced?
My broad answer is no. I think certainly vitamins are always good to take. There's not really compelling evidence that any of those things are going to help you reduce your symptoms at all.
People just want that silver bullet, don't they? They want something that this will help or that will help. And if you see something online saying it will cure it, it's a scam. That's what I keep telling people.
Yeah, and when I tell people for those types of things, if there was any money to be made, it would probably be the pharmaceutical companies doing that to market that. They get a lot of bad rap sometimes because people say they're just in it for the money, but you can't have it both ways. So I think that if there was money to be made, certainly I think the pharmaceutical companies would try to market it as much as possible and get it to many people as possible.
Let's go to Debbie and Lee Summit. Debbie, good afternoon. Hello. You're on with the doctor.
Hi. First of all, thank you for trying to keep things normal. It's great. Doctor, thank you for everything that you are doing. Dana, you took my question about wiping on the groceries. But I want to go one step further. Is soap and water okay to use as a wipe down? I have a problem with strong chemicals.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The nice thing, one of the nice things about this virus is that it is very susceptible to soap and water. That's why we do stress hand washing so much with soap and water. And if you don't have soap and water, certainly use alcohol gels. But if you're talking about surfaces in your home, absolutely soap and water is going to be good for destroying this virus.
Hey, doctor, as an infectious disease guy, when this is all said and done, what are the one, two, or even three things that you most want to see or know out of the research? You know, we all have 1,000 questions about this thing. What are the big ones for you that you can't wait to get the answer to blank?
I think the full disease spectrum, what happens from the time that you're infected to the time when you feel symptoms to the time when you become critically ill. We don't have a lot of information about that. And this goes along with also what can we do to stop it. So the vaccine or the therapeutics, the drugs to use for it, and what timing? Is there timing of drugs that we have to use? Is it better early on rather than late? Things of that nature. And I think, You know, the best evidence we have right now is from the original SARS back in 2002, 2003. But I would really, we certainly need to apply it to this infection because this is still quite different from that.
So, SARS and MERS both died off for the most part. Is this going to die off as well, or are we going to be dealing with this a year from now?
Yeah, that is a great question. That is something we are trying to answer. Certainly people hoped, and I think we all hoped it died off before it got to the United States. There was concern that it would become a seasonal thing. Maybe it's going to be like influenza and the other respiratory viral illnesses, die off in the spring now, but come back more in the fall. Will it ever die down? I don't know. Or the thought is, unfortunately, is this going to continue to be like influenza and the other respiratory viruses and come back year after year? So I think we just need to, number one, continue to work on therapeutics, continue to work on a vaccine, and just kind of we have to, unfortunately, see what happens over the next few months as far as that goes.
What do we know, Doctor, about the mutation of this? I know everyone is studying this every single day around the globe. The problem with the flu is it changes year to year. What do we know, and is there any good news on the horizon about COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I think luckily, you know, initially there were two strange strains, what they called S and L. You know, and there is a very good website to look at the phylogeny, basically look at how the virus has diverged since the original one. And really, in the isolates that they've had, the divergence is not that much. So it really hasn't changed that much from China back in December until now. There's a little bit of mutations, but there's been really nothing significant to speak of as far as increasing the infectivity or the severity of this. And I think we just got to kind of continue to watch it. That's all we're able to do. Certainly any vaccine, we want to make sure it's to an area on the virus that we don't think is going to mutate or change too much so that we always have that target to vaccinate against.
Doctor, before we get to Jim in Topeka, who's next, do you think that, you know, we hear about this 30 days that the president and his administration are talking about. Do you think on May 1st we'll be walking outside and going to work?
I would love for that to happen.
What do you think?
I think we need more data. I think we need into, you know, middle or late next week to really understand where we're at. And I think once we have that, you know, we'll be in the middle of April at that point. We'll have a lot better recognition of where we're at here locally, but also nationally. And I think it's certainly good if New York is maybe peaking or having an improvement. I think Seattle started to have an improvement. Are we just a couple weeks behind them, or did we really flatten the curve? I think we'll definitely have more information by next week. And as Dr. Fauci said, you know, it's the virus's timeline. It's not ours. So all we can do is do what we can do, stay home, social distance, wash your hands, and then go from there.
Let's bring in Jim in Topeka. Jim, good afternoon. Hello.
Good afternoon. Question about the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
If the immune system isn't challenged, it can turn on the body and other things too. So in our efforts to keep ourselves so clean, we essentially take ourselves out of the herd, so we lose some herd immunity, plus our own immune system becomes compromised and weakened. So at what point does that become a problem?
Doctor?
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated question. Certainly we think that for some childhood things, such as allergies or asthma, being in too sterile an environment, you don't get the natural sampling. You know, the big analogy that's always brought up is, yet certainly kids in the city with really sterile environments, a lot of them seem to have asthma now, a lot of them have allergies, but look at the child growing up in western Kansas out exposed on the farm to all these other things. I don't think that necessarily applies here. This is a fully new virus. You know, nobody has seen it before. Herd immunity is not just a simple thing that, you know, 50% of the population. For herd immunity, you really need a lot more of the population to have been exposed to that type of thing. But for the most part, again, this is still a new infection for everybody. And it's the virus itself, and we just don't know how to, our body is still not fully capable of dealing with it in an appropriate way, or something that we're used to for other things like common cough and cold viruses.
Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System joining us on the hotline, 576-7798.
Little ditty about Jack and Diane, two American kids growing up in the heartland.
John Cougar Mellencamp.
Jackie gonna be a football star.
On a Tuesday throwback to the 80s, Dr. Dana Hawkinson, who is very generous with his time, joins us on the hotline. Doctor, you said something that in the last segment that made me think of something. You said, we're dealing with a totally new virus.
Yeah.
How does a virus just start?
Well, it's eons old. I mean, viruses, microorganisms, bacteria, you know, those have been around for a long time. They've been in all other animals. They've been in humans. They've jumped from humans to other animals. They jump from other animals to humans. You know, we know that there are, this is probably SARS and MERS are probably originated in bats and probably found some intermediate hosts and now have kind of jumped into humans. We know that there's, we have given other viruses to other animals as well. So it's something that happens, you know, fairly commonly. All these microorganisms have been around a lot longer than we have.
I was surprised by the news this week on a couple of fronts that a tiger, I believe at the Bronx Zoo, has tested positive. Some other tigers have symptoms. Mm-hmm. My first thought was I was just ticked off that somehow they had a test for a tiger and Americans can't get tests. But what is it about this virus that seems to be able to jump to pets or animals? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is I guess pets if you're watching Tiger King. Should we worry about our pets? And do the other viruses also have the ability to jump to things like tigers, like the SARS and the MERS?
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to say, be glad you're not sticking the swab up the tiger's nose.
Right.
But, you know, those are very good questions. And from day one, even the CDC and then their guidance for home isolation and home quarantine is if you have animals or pets, it's probably better if you have somebody help take care of the pets for you. Again, we know this has happened. We've all heard of swine flu. We've all heard of bird flu. So when these viruses get into these other animals, and we know they can jump species, now some of them may not cause disease in these species, but they can certainly also interact with other viruses. There's always the potential for further mutations. It's very important, and we know that this has happened before, and it can happen again, to try and prevent that. Because we never know what can happen. We don't know exactly how this jumped species or when it became virulent to us, when it became a pathogen to us. But we know those things certainly can continue to occur, especially moving forward. You know, we understand that there are over 500 known coronaviruses in bats with thousands more that we anticipate or estimated that we don't even know about.
Mm. Well, how about we just stop eating bats?
You know, I think maybe trying to prevent as many species jumps as possible, and certainly, you know, the live animal markets have been implicated a lot. Those are things that, you know, certainly should be looked at.
Let's go to Dave in Smithville with the last question of the hour. Hi, Dave.
Hey, guys. Hey, doctor. Thanks for taking my call, by the way. There was an article in the New York Times either this morning or yesterday that really piqued my interest. And it was an article by a doctor, written by a doctor in New York City, who's a cardiologist. And his question was, where are all the heart attack and stroke patients?
Yeah.
Because they have seen a marked decline in the folks that they normally see. And it could it be that these people are being coded COVID-19 when in actuality they are there because of cardiac or heart issues, or stroke?
Doctor?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good question. You know, we were asked a couple days ago, well, how many patients do you have on the vents? And we said it, but, you know, we still have a lot of patients who are on the ventilator for reasons other than COVID, because they've had a stroke or maybe because they had a massive heart attack. You know, these things are still going on. We do still see those in our hospital. So it is a very real thing. I can't speak for New York. But certainly for the health system here, you know, we are seeing those. And unfortunately, people are continuing to get ill from things that we've seen before COVID. That is heart attack. That is stroke. That's pneumonia from other organisms, other bacteria, other viruses as well. So those things are continuing to happen. And we want to create and we have a safe place for those patients as well, because they need critical care services and hospital services as well.
Doctor, is there any silver lining, and I'm stretching here, to try to find a silver lining throughout all that has happened in the past weeks and quite frankly, past administrations? Is there any silver lining in that if, God forbid, this were to happen again, there is a very broad global understanding of what these viruses can do to a society?
We have 30 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the smartest people who I've heard talk and who knows what he's talking about is Bill Gates. And he identified this type of thing a few years ago, and he wanted to pump as much money as he could into these things to help with research and help with vaccine and drugs. And hopefully this will be an impetus to jumpstart that now and have other countries buy in. And, you know, the money's there. We just need to continue to do the research and look and do the drug discovery and the vaccine discovery. And hopefully that will be the silver lining at this point.
Doctor, always good to talk to you. You're so generous with your time and your expertise. Thank you for it. We do appreciate it more than you will ever know.
All right. Thank you. I enjoy talking to you.
All right. We'll talk soon. That is Dr. Dana Hawkinson with the University of Kansas Health System. Dana Wright, Sam Stevie III. The news is next. I'm Scott Parks on KMBZ.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.